from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was known for creating one of the world's most famous fictional detectives, Sherlock Holmes. But in real life, Conan Doyle was a physician and a medical sleuth, much like his other creation, John Watson. In his new book, The Remedy, author Thomas Goetz tells the story of how Conan Doyle investigated rumors of a cure for tuberculosis and how his detective work into this medical mystery may have inspired the Sherlock Holmes stories. Thomas Goetz joins us for the hour. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. San Francisco-based author Thomas Goetz joins us for this Forum Hour. The former executive editor of Wired is a science journalist whose writing was selected for the Best American Science Writing and the Best Technology Writing Anthologies. He's co-founder of a health technology company called Iodine, and he recently published Remedy, a book all about Sherlock Holmes creator Arthur Conan Doyle, scientific researcher Robert Koch, and the quest to cure tuberculosis. Thomas Goetz joins us in studio for the second hour. Welcome back to Forum.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Let me kind of set the stage here with the listeners. Most people don't even have probably much idea just how deadly a disease tuberculosis was. I mean, historically, the pervasiveness of death and the early deaths, it was leading cause of death in the United States and Europe. But aside from that, kind of the worst disease humanity's ever known, as you put it.
Yeah, it was a stunning disease. And that was one of the things I tried to make clear at the beginning, was just to give a sense of how pervasive it was and how inescapable it was. So as you say, a quarter of Americans, a quarter of Europeans died of the disease. And it was a disease that people had no sense of what was causing it. So it was both confounding and ubiquitous.
They, thought it was caused by all kind. They thought it was kind of a cancer, and they thought it was caused by all sorts of things.
Heredity,
familial, yeah. Climate, even sloth. Consumption was identified with all those things.
Pretty much anything but germs.
And a constitutional disorder. So we're setting the stage here because we're talking about the man who actually found what caused tuberculosis. But let's also set the stage a little with you in terms of medicine at that day, so that people, since you mentioned germs, they weren't washing their hands before surgeries. They weren't washing their hands really before delivering babies.
I mean, no.
There were all these humors and leeches and cod liver oil and just a whole different world of medicine.
Yeah, no, it was still in there. This is just the 1870s, 1880s, and it was still bloodletting was in vogue. And it was in many ways just the other side of the modern age of medicine that we enjoy now. And what is kind of stunning to realize is this is not even 150 years ago.
And TB was not an epidemic. It was an endemic, right? It was a white plague, they were calling it, because there was a lot of white noise of that illness, as you point out in your book. But it was, like you say, pervasive.
Right. So TB was, unlike other infectious diseases like cholera or smallpox, which would come on in great waves, the plague being the kind of the most evocative and fearful. TB was a disease that was always there. It was basically everybody in the population was exposed and was a carrier of the disease. And so it was really only a matter of when certain people would come down with it and the bacteria would actually break through the body's immune system and kind of take hold. And then it was, years of agony, of pain, of dealing with the disease before ultimately people would die. So it was a very different kind of infectious disease. And, I should be clear, it's still rife in Africa, in India, China. TB is still
still cases south of the border and in here, too.
Indeed.
Yeah. But Robert Koch, you mentioned cholera. I mean, he's a guy who discovered really the way to cure cholera, and he discovered the reason behind tuberculosis was a bacteria or a germ or microbe, whatever we want to call it. And he thought, he was probably the most famous scientific researcher of his day.
He was. He and Louis Pasteur, who was his great rival, and true to their national stereotypes, Koch was the kind of diligent, very focused German, and Louis Pasteur, who was older than Koch, but he was a very flamboyant Frenchman, and they had very different styles, and they really the kind of European scene of the 1870s, 1880s was, at least in a scientific sense, these two men racing each other to identify and potentially give cures or treatments or antidotes for these diseases, these infectious diseases.
So we're talking about the beginning of the microscope, really. I mean, coming into some degree of prominence and discovering that there's a germ behind tuberculosis, which was the gravity that held was enormous. And yet he also thought he had the remedy. That is, Koch thought he had the remedy.
Right. So Pasteur had a better knack for treatments than Koch did. Koch was all about this method of really detective work and being able to identify the cause of a disease. And that was a huge breakthrough at the time. Making causation a fact was something that really changed the course of medicine and science. But Pasteur was able to kind of go this next step and to actually create vaccines. So he created a vaccine for anthrax and a vaccine for rabies. And Koch, you know, wanted some of that greater glory. And so he worked for many years on TB, having identified the bacteria that caused TB in 1882. He wanted the greater glory that came with a cure. And in 1890, he made the announcement that he had that remedy.
This was a thing called tuberculin, right?
It became called tuberculin. Yeah, which is still used today. It's used today as a way to diagnose the disease.
But he gave this big, what we would call today, a dog and pony show in Berlin, saying, yeah, "I've got the remedy for tuberculosis." Now, this is where Arthur Conan Doyle comes in.
Yeah,
I mean, he was just a regular doctor, like Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes' sidekick. But he was also on assignment for a newspaper, Popular Monthly. So he goes to Berlin and sees this and take it from there.
Right. So he had Conan Doyle had been inspired by Robert Koch throughout his career. So Conan Doyle was about 10, 15, 20 years younger than Koch, and in medical school was learning about this new germ theory and learning about the power of this new medicine, what they called at the time scientific medicine, as if it was different from ordinary medicine. And Koch was a great hero of scientific medicine. And so Conan Doyle really saw him as part of a wave of this new really medicine that could help people, which was a profound shift. Medicine before the germ theory, it was really something that could maybe at best be palliative, make you feel a little more calm or at ease, but it could do nothing to actually help you. And the germ theory started to change that, because all of a sudden you had vaccines, all of a sudden you had ways to actually move people away from germs. So Conan Doyle was a proponent of that in his own small way. And so when he read the announcement that Koch had this remedy, he was motivated and inspired to basically drop everything and rush to Berlin to see this demonstration, to see history in the making.
And we're talking about a scientific method, a deductive reasoning, really, here. When we think about Sherlock Holmes, we think about, I always used to love the word ratiocination, you know.
Yes, nice.
Go through
nice.
A deductive process. But that's really what kind of inspired him to look up to Koch as a sort of mentoring figure.
Right. So I'm glad you mentioned this, because this was actually one of the kind of fascinating things. There was certainly no shortage of scientists in the U.S. and Europe at the time. But the problem was, the challenge was, that each scientific university or institution had its own method for doing an experiment and its own standards for proof and evidence. And so ultimately you had a lot of people making claims for scientific facts, but no evidence that could actually convince their colleagues, convince the greater kind of environment or ecosystem of scientists that any one claim was true. And so when Koch came along with what we now know as Koch's postulates, when he came along with this very thorough process of establishing causation, that process became the shift that all of a sudden people realized, okay, there is an incontrovertible level of evidence here. And that shift started to become, started to make possible the advances of modern medicine.
We're talking to Thomas Goetz. His book is The Remedy, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. So Conan Doyle arrives in Berlin as a physician, you say, and he leaves as a writer.
Yeah.
But the two never really met, I mean, face to face.
Yeah. So it was, what I loved about this story was how, you know, it's one of these classic examples of two great giants of history in a kind of unexpected encounter, and it's not giving away too much to say that they actually had what could be in many ways the nearest of near misses. There's this one moment where Conan Doyle wants to see the demonstration in Berlin. He doesn't have a ticket. And in out of desperation, he goes to the great Koch's house and he rings the doorbell. The butler lets him in. And as he's waiting downstairs, the postman comes in. He sees the postman dump out this pile of letters, which is letters from around Europe and around the world, people wanting a piece of this cure. They're desperate people with tuberculosis. So the pile of letters dumps out on the floor. And Conan Doyle is standing there waiting to see if Koch will see him. And the butler comes back down and says, no, he doesn't have time to meet this anonymous. Conan Doyle was at that time an anonymous English scientist. So Conan Doyle leaves embarrassed and ends up trying to scam his way into the demonstration other ways. But that was as close as they came. And yet the two of them were so entwined in terms of their own careers, because what ends up happening is Conan Doyle ends up basically playing detective and doing the math in these few days in Berlin and ascertaining that for all the fanfare, for all the glory that Koch was after, the remedy probably wouldn't work. And the science that Conan Doyle deployed was actually very astute. It was spot on. And so he ended up debunking, being the first one to debunk Koch's remedy. Now, the kind of quest of that process was so inspiring to Conan Doyle that on his way back to England, he decides that he's going to give up his practice and move to London and devote himself to writing. And those first stories will be the Sherlock Holmes stories.
But there's also this figure of Dr. Joseph Bell, Edinburgh yes. teacher, who was really, I think, generally credited with being the major inspiration for the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I discussed Bell and the kind of role he played. And Bell is very well known in the kind of lore of Sherlockians and the Conan Doyle scholarship. So there's no doubting that Bell, who was a really great diagnostician and a teacher of Conan Doyle's in Edinburgh, no denying that he was by far the main inspiration. But what I was really trying to do in this book was to show how Conan Doyle was not a singular figure of history, that he was actually very much engaged in the kind of evolution of science and the evolution of medicine that was going on all around Europe at the time, and how Conan Doyle was inspired by that shift. And you know, one of the things that I try to point out in the book was for all that we associate Sherlock Holmes with that magnifying glass, the first tool that Sherlock Holmes actually uses in the Sherlock Holmes stories is a microscope. It's not the magnifying glass. It's this tool of bacteriologists and microbiology. And it's a little bit more scientific than we give Sherlock Holmes credit for.
It's also the time with the rise of the stethoscope around contemporary.
Indeed, there was a profusion of scopes. Every orifice had its own scope, and they all were invented at that time.
And there's also the personal side of this. I mean, Conan Doyle, the love of his life, had tuberculosis, and both men were, in a sense, I think, as you put it, undone by TB.
Yeah, so that happened the next year. That happened the year after Conan Doyle went to Berlin and had this kind of epiphany that he should devote himself to writing, and specifically the Sherlock Holmes stories. That next year, his wife was diagnosed with TB, and so began his own decade-long process in caring for her, trying to find a cure, trying to find something that would improve her condition. And you know, after 10, 12 years, she finally succumbed to the disease.
We were saying before, though, that Koch was a leading scientist. Even before he discovered the cause of tuberculosis, he'd made significant discoveries, actually found the organism that caused cholera, for example. But
yep.
Later on, he believed in fairies?
Conan Doyle did. Conan Doyle did.
Conan Doyle believed in
yes,
fairies.
Conan yes, Conan Doyle believed in fairies.
Which is pretty extraordinary when you think about it.
I yeah.
mean, for a man as rational and as deductive and following the scientific method of Koch and so forth.
So they both, that was one of the kind of very interesting kind of echoes of the two men's lives, was they both had this, they both found their fame through a very rigorous process. So Conan Doyle's stories were all about creating a new kind of detective story where it wasn't coincidence, but it was very clearly facts that were laid out in the story. And that was part of the joy for readers, was that they could actually follow along and solve the mystery themselves if they paid close enough attention. And what ended up happening was Conan Doyle, for all his scientific grounding, in his later years, he went off into the what was called spiritualism, this belief in the occult and in fairies, and he had this
Madame Blavatsky and all that.
Yeah,
stuff.
it was
theosophy.
This,
yeah.
It was very in many ways it was very embarrassing, and many of the fans of Sherlock Holmes were embarrassed for Conan Doyle. But he kept on churning out the stories, and he kept on putting out the Sherlock Holmes stories. So they gave him, you know, they gave him a pass for that as long as he came up with the goods.
But how do we know then the connection between how much Conan Doyle was inspired by Coke, how much that scientific method inspired him?
Well, so Conan Doyle made many references throughout his career to Coke's work. So early on in 1883, he wrote an essay called "Life and Death in the Blood," where he had this very powerful scene of Coke and Pasteur at work, and really paid them great homage for the advances that they were uncorking in their labs. And then go fast 50 years later, at the end of his career, Conan Doyle would give speeches to medical schools, and he would again reference Coke as really the singular agent of this new scientific medicine. So throughout his career, Conan Doyle was very diligent in acknowledging the role that Coke played in his own career, as well as this great shift in society towards scientific medicine, the same kind of scientific medicine that we enjoy today.
And Thomas Goetz, our guest, his book is Remedy, Robert Coke, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. There's a larger umbrella, I think, or context for this story that you have in your book and that you work out. It sort of really speaks to the nature of scientific research, that progress is made, I think I'm quoting here, more by darkness than by light, and that there's really no easy remedies. I mean, that they come sometimes even by chance, by caprice, by accident.
Yeah, so that was one of the things I think any historian has this sense throughout their work that history is in many ways accidents. It's not ordained. And so for me, in the writing of this book, that was something that I became very that impressed me very much was that, you know, there were many turns and twists where if not through persistence, if not through a good stroke of luck, the kind of course of this story and the course of science itself could have taken a very different turn. And that's something I think we you know, as lay people, as people who are on the beneficial side of science, we take it for granted that medicine will have tools to treat us these days. You know, we take for granted that even in the case of cancer or heart disease, that there will be something that can help us. But all of those kind of, if not cures, all of those treatments are the work of very hard, diligent science, which you know, those roads are paved with failure and false starts and false promises. And so for me to really be able to unpack that process and to look at one remedy, you know, such as it was, one of those remedies that was supposed to change the world. I mean, it was again, the most devastating diseases at the time. And then here comes the cure, and then it's not. And kind of painting that process and showing how both the hopes of entire nations and the entire world were pinned on this one discovery, only to have them come to naught.
We're talking about the last half of the 19th century, or at least, as you say, as you figured it, about a quarter of all deaths were attributed to tuberculosis, and also a time when, as we've said, the microscope, the stethoscope, all kinds of changes were taking place and kind of careening with one another. How much or how important was it that Gray's Anatomy was published back in 1858?
You know, I thought it's actually not – I think it's very it's very right that Gray's Anatomy would come along at that time. So the idea of mapping, this is a kind of theme in the book, and also something that I think is true in science, in medicine as well, is part of the power of discovery or treatment or cures is simply being able to see something. So it's not necessarily having a secret remedy so much as it is knowing that something exists, so you should do something about it. And what I mean is, as Coke's insight about the existence of a tuberculosis bacteria started to spread throughout medicine, people started to plot where tuberculosis cases were in cities. So this happened first in New York City with Herman Biggs, and they
started epidemiology. Really.
Yeah, exactly. And so just being able to see disease and just being able to understand basically the map, whether that map is one of a city or the body itself, that knowledge of where things happen is a very powerful tool to science and medicine. And it's really something that emerged as a strategy in that last half of the 19th century. And it's still one, you know, it's still one we wrestle with today. There's research just a couple of years ago that showed that twice as many people were dying of malaria as had been thought, which is rather staggering to think that right now in 2014, 2012, we would be off by 100% in terms of just knowing how many people are dying of disease. But that's because it's a very hard problem. Being able to see disease, being able to know where it exists is in many ways the biggest and hardest part of the problem.
Just in reading your book, I couldn't help thinking about all of the great minds that we lost much sooner than we should have because of consumption, because of tuberculosis. I mean, just in the literary world that I truck around in, you know, Chekhov and Eugene O'Neill and Kafka, and the list just goes on and on.
Yeah, there's a whole Wikipedia entry devoted to people who have died of tuberculosis.
You ever read Magic Mountain?
Yes. Yes.
It's a great work. Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, in terms of really bringing tuberculosis into a kind of focus. That's what we're doing this hour, but also talking about scientific research and scientific cures and looking at the history of medicine, the quest to cure tuberculosis with Thomas Goetz tying in Robert Koch, a name that's probably forgotten through history, but at his time was perhaps one of the most famous and most highly venerated scientific researchers, as Thomas Goetz said, a major rival of Louis Pasteur. I'd like to invite those of you listening to join us in the conversation here, and you may have some thoughts about scientific research. You may have some thoughts about, Robert Koch, if you know the name, or Arthur Conan and Doyle. May even have some aficionados of Sherlock Holmes who would like to join the program. You are welcome to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and we do welcome your call, so feel free to join us. It's all about identifying the bacteria that cause tuberculosis, which really revolutionized medicine and revolutionized scientific research. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. But we really invite you to join the conversation and would be pleased to hear from you. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and feel free, especially like to hear from some of you scientists or scientific researchers, fledgling or otherwise, just in terms of talking about what we're talking about, which is how things, remedies, for example, can happen not only through diligence and through perseverance and hard scientific work, but also sometimes just by caprice and accidents and not necessarily knowing what's going on with another scientific researcher who may be working even right across the hall from you, let alone across the world from you. This story really inspired you, and I know you had fun writing it, but tell us about sort of the germ or the microbe for this story. What got you started?
Sure. So my father is a physician, and when I was starting to go to Berkeley to get my master's of public health, he sent me this great essay that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was about this little anecdote in history, this meeting or almost meeting between Conan Doyle and Koch, and it was a great little essay, and I thought, there's a book in that.
That was the essay. That did it. And here you are. The book, again, is A Remedy. Thomas Goetz, the author. We'll hear from you. We'll bring you into the conversation when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Thomas Goetz, San Francisco-based author, and I should mention also head of a co-founder of something called Iodine, which is a digital health company based in San Francisco. Also authored a book that we featured on Forum called The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. So he has a lot to do with public health. He mentioned he has a master's degree from UC Berkeley in public health, also a master's degree in English from University of Virginia.
Yes.
A man of many colors, a Renaissance man, studied John Donne and all that, and now has written this book about Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. Let's go to our callers and let's begin, George, with you. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. This, of course, I'm an epidemiologist, so of course this is a fascinating story. I would like to point out one historical fact that's another part of the story, which is that the actual declines in mortality from tuberculosis started well before the bacillus was discovered. And probably this is pointed out by the historian Thomas McCune many, many years ago, and probably had to do with improved living conditions. McCune thought it was diet. It was probably more general than that. It is this general problem that the germ theory supplanted our attention to what some of us call upstream causes of disease, and we've yet to get much traction back on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think I would quibble a little bit. I think in some sense the downturn of TB was in some sense really put forward because of the knowledge of germs. It was the boost that the germ theory gave to the hygiene and sanitation movements that caused the profusion of sanatoriums and better drinking water and all those kind of big social shifts started, as you say, a little bit before the actual evidence of germs, but really were propelled once the germs were actually identified. And you're exactly right. By the time antibiotics came along, the actual cure in the 1950s, the actual prevalence of TB was just a fraction of what it had been back when the germ theory scientists were at their work.
And George, thank you for the call. Let me get to another caller here. That's Jim. Jim, you're on. Hi.
Thank you. I teach microbiology, and this is a story that I tell the students, that discovery of the bacillus that causes tuberculosis is in the context of what we call the golden age of microbiology, where most bacterial diseases had the particular bacterium that causes them discovered. But what I say is that the tuberculosis bacterium was so difficult. It's hard to stain. It's really small. It grows very slowly. It's fastidious. That is, it's hard to grow. That it took the master himself, Robert Koch, who developed most of the techniques. So the techniques that we use in microbiology today pretty much were pretty much developed in his lab. Petri of Petri dish fame was his student. Frau Hesse developed auger, the solidifying agent that he used to. So really, Koch was the man. But what I wanted to ask the author is I've often thought that a knowledge of this period of how bad things were, what a slaughter tuberculosis and other diseases caused for both adults and children, where you had 50% mortality. If people knew the history, then there wouldn't be a backlash against vaccinations, that there wouldn't be the taking for granted of antibiotics. There wouldn't be this idea of taking our modern advances for granted, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for the call. Thomas Goetz.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I talk about this in the book as one of the paradoxes of the germ theory is that, you know, having removed our experience with infectious disease, you know, it's no longer part of the fabric of daily life, and so we have the kind of privilege of not having to face these diseases and not having to experience their costs and their tolls, and in many ways that has made us get lazy with things like vaccines, which I think is a horrible.
It's made us immune to the importance of vaccines.
Yeah, indeed, and it's in fact, in some sense, it has caused us to overcorrect. The whole hygiene hypothesis that we've so scoured germs from our environments that now we are disabling our immune systems by not exposing ourselves to enough germs. So it's in many ways something that I think we're only just starting to find the right balance in terms of our relationship with germs.
We'll take another call. That's you, Lawrence, from Walnut Creek. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm a physician, and during medical school, I was given talks, lectures, and then there's a book called History of Medicine by Charles Bodimer, Dr. Charles Bodimer, and told me that they used to infect people purposely with malaria by exposure to areas of malaria mosquitoes. They'd catch malaria and have high spiking fevers, 105-plus degrees fevers from the malaria, and what that would do is it would fire up the immune system, and that would contain people that had tuberculosis, because tuberculosis can be contained by the body. People live it for decades sometimes without any problems from until they get weak from old age or whatever. So the point is, and then they treat the malaria with quinine and cure the person of malaria. And so that this fever therapy actually is also being explored and used right now in the form of hyperthermia for cancer treatments in Japan and Kansas City. And I'm just curious about what your comments would be about the, if you'd heard about that and your comments. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Lawrence.
I had not, I confess, I had not heard about the fever cure as something that was being used today. I do know that, you know, that's what they thought that when Koch had his remedy, they thought it was in essence a fever cure. And at the time of his work in the 1890s, 1900, this is when his associate Paul Ehrlich was just starting the work on the immune system, and I think that's one of the things that you your story makes clear is that we're still just figuring out the immune system. All these new diseases, the autoimmune disorders that we're still grappling with, asthma, arthritis. You know, we there is a great mystery to our immune system, and if you know if we can figure out the right triggers to make it work more on our behalf, I think those are very promising areas.
Includes the mystery of which you alluded to before in terms of how germ free we can be and how that will affect the immune system.
Indeed.
Talking again with Thomas Goetz, he's the author of The Remedy, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and The Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. He'll be appearing, actually, at the Mill Valley Library in early August. You may want to make note of that. And you also may want to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, if you have question or comment or would like simply to join the conversation. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll go to Santa Rosa and welcome Sue onto the air. Sue, hi.
Good morning. Wonderful show. I'm a retired medical technologist, medical lab technologist, from the days when we did it all by hand. But I want to tell everybody on the air that I believe that the book Microbe Hunters by, I believe, Paul DeCroix,
yeah,
should be required reading of every high school student, because people simply don't understand the importance of bacteria and the discoveries of the drugs and the especially the immunizations that they should have. It's appalling to me that all of that work by those wonderful men is being ignored by a huge number of the population who think themselves well-educated. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Sue.
Well, I have to congratulate Michael on having the most educated audience I've ever heard of. If anybody's not a scientist or a practicing physician, they're not listening. Microbe Hunters is one of my favorite books, and it was in many ways an inspiration. That the style is a little out of date these days, but I think about the great story of Semmelweis that Michael, you referenced earlier, the idea of not washing hands, and Semmelweis's discovery in the 1850s that you know, in this maternity ward, that the wealthy women were dying of sepsis because the medical students were going straight from the autopsy room to the birthing rooms and not washing their hands in between, and where the poor women were getting treated by midwives, and so they were surviving in much better rates. Those kinds of discoveries, which are just profoundly horrible to think about, how you know, grotesque that is in many ways. But those insights, in many ways, were tenuous. It took decades for people to start believing Semmelweis. He actually died in an insane asylum because no one would believe him. And it wasn't until people like Koch and Pasteur and the kind of next generation after them started to make this science not only something that people had to believe in, but something that society could benefit from. And that's something I try to point out in the book is how there's actually a big distance between a scientific discovery and a social truth. And that's a much harder argument in some sense to convince society to change its behaviors. And I think it's one that we still struggle with and we still are fighting today.
Can you talk a little bit more about the rivalry between Koch and Pasteur? I mean, a lot of it was for glory, obviously, but it was deeper than that.
Yeah, so it was, well, it came out of, it came in some sense directly out of the Franco-Prussian War. So Koch was the Franco-Prussian War was in the 1870, it was only about 18 months, I believe, maybe not even that long. But it it was the first war, in some sense, the first modern war between France and Germany, the new German state, and Koch served on the front lines in field hospitals. Pasteur was a generation older, so he wasn't serving, but his son was, and they both were, in many ways, driven by this patriotism, their own national pride, and so when they started to butt heads over first anthrax, they were both trying to make inroads on the science of anthrax, and then later they had a race across the globe to discover the cause of cholera. It was really infused by this national rivalry, and it was egged on in many senses by their national governments. The French government was pouring funds into Pasteur's lab, the Institute of Pasteur in Paris, and Koch was jealous, and he wanted the same sort of facilities, and he wanted the same sort of recognition. And so as his ambition was driven to get more resources and larger staff, he also wanted to better Pasteur in the lab. And so they had this amazing moment, as one of the callers referred to it as the golden age of microbiology, because they just went tit for tat over the years in discovery after discovery. And it, in many ways, it was showing the worst side of both men, because they were incredibly egotistical and got into this very public spat with open letters that were all sorts of name calling and really not what you expect of the greatest scientists of history. But it's my sense that rivalry really propelled science forward. That drive to better the rival was really essential to making better science and to making the progress of science much faster. So it was both this kind of embarrassing, horrible side of humanity, but also kind of our better side as well.
No, it was a deep competition, and probably had results from that competition. But the irony is, you heard the caller who said, you know, Koch was the man. I mean, you know, in terms of microbiology and all that. Most school kids know the name Louis Pasteur. They don't know the name Robert Koch.
Yeah, well, so Koch, so Pasteur has pasteurization, right? Which of course was invented to purge milk of tuberculosis, because bovine tuberculosis was a major cause of tuberculosis in kids. So pasteurization took care of that, and so we know Pasteur because he has this kind of, it's on our milk cartons every day. And likewise, Listerine, right? This, who's another kind of scientist of the day, who brought the germ theory into operating rooms. We know him through
halitosis, maybe.
Yeah, Lister, Joseph Lister, not Listerine, but Listerine. We know him because the product was named after him. But Joseph Lister was also very kind of publicly recognized. But Koch was a scientist first, and as one of the callers said, a technologist. He created the tools that made for better science. But those sort of inroads don't register as much in the popular imagination. So in some sense, that's one of the things I was trying to do, was to put his work back in that social context.
Do we know why Conan Doyle, it's the old Alan Sherman,
yeah, yeah.
Conan Doyle, both nice. why he had Dr. Watson as a kind of surrogate physician and didn't make Sherlock Holmes a doctor?
You know, there are Holmesologists who are better versed at the mysteries of this than I, but to me the sense was, you know, what Conan Doyle did with Watson and Holmes was really bifurcate
his own identity,
but also this kind of two men of science, two men of medicine. So Watson, of course, we think of him as kind of bumbling,
yeah.
But in fact, he was just not quite as smart as Conan Doyle or as Holmes. And one of the things that's important to note is that Sherlock Holmes was not the omniscient detective that we think of these days. He wasn't a know-it-all. He had very peculiar, very deep knowledge in certain areas. But there were many areas that he was completely ignorant of. And in some sense, the Watson's broadness complements Holmes's particular and peculiar genius.
Go to another caller, and Janice, that's you. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've recently been to one of our big local medical centers and the hospital also, and there's signs all over the wall asking, putting responsibility onto the patient to ask the doctors to wash their hands. And then what they have in the rooms, in examining rooms, in the hallways, are these dispensers with some kind of antibacterial goop. And isn't that like increasing the, aren't we told not to use that stuff? What am I missing?
That's a very good point. So those are, it's actually not antibiotics that are being disseminated. Those are usually alcohol based or some other astringent. But that is a very effective way of killing bacteria in the hospitals. And hospitals, ironically, are a major source of infections because they are kind of caught in this. They are the epicenter of this cat and mouse game between man and microbe, and so. You know, we've created sterile atmospheres where certain strains of bacteria in hospitals are basically evolving and outstripping the pace and power of our astringents or our antibiotics. So in terms of the day-to-day process in hospitals, we need doctors to wash their hands. We need to have those be clean environments because we want to avoid hospital infections. Hospital infections cause tens of thousands of deaths a year. But on the larger sense, I think you're exactly right. On the larger sense, we need to be mindful of our overuse of antibiotics, and we need to be mindful of the fact that not all germs are pathogens in the sense that some germs are beneficial to us. And as I said, you know, we are only now just starting to tease out the pros and cons of the microbe and the microbiome.
Well, you go into restaurant restrooms and they say employees are required to wash their hands.
Yes.
You know, who's watching the employees wash their hands? Who's monitoring that? Recently, I got a sandwich and the person who was making the sandwich had gloves on, but then answered the phone, you know, when it rang. I thought, there's something kind of
yes,
cross purposes here. Let me go to some of your emails. Nanny writes, my father was cured in the early 1920s when he was about 24 years old. He went to some sanitarium in the Alps, Switzerland perhaps, and had his diseased lung collapse for some time. What is known about this treatment?
Yeah, so they used to have all sorts of rather macabre surgical interventions for tuberculosis. So they used to do lobectomies, you know, removing parts of a lung or entire lungs. They would collapse the lung with the theory that it would basically cut off the disease and starve the bacteria. Those sometimes worked for some people. They would, but they were in many ways horrific treatments. You know, they were really invasive surgeries, removing people's ribs, removing people's.
And who knew if they weren't lungs. Just getting rid of the disease for other reasons, which is not uncommon, or well, uncommon enough with all the death. But there were people who were cured somehow, or the disease left them.
Yeah, they tried anything. I mean, there was people who believed that dog's blood, transfusions of dog's blood, was curative for tuberculosis. So,
well, here's Robert who writes, reading Journey to the End of the Night by Louis Ferdinand Céline led me to the history of Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis, who had mm-hmm. been the subject of Céline's PhD thesis. I didn't know that. And, you know, I read Céline many years ago, one of the most anti-Semitic writers of all time. But he had done a thesis on Semmelweis?
I didn't know that either.
Oh, okay. See, you do.
You come on
right
forum and you learn more.
You're right about absolutely. We got the best listenership anywhere on the planet. Here's Joe who writes, that you are more disturbed, I know he's talking about you or me, Thomas, that you are more disturbed by or scornful of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle believing in fairies than you are by many scientists then and now believing in God is simply metaphysical prejudice and silly.
Well, interesting point. I'll say this. So what Conan Doyle actually believed in were paper cutouts of fairies. So I think we can all agree that those were not true. But I think there is a germ of a good point in that note, because there's a lot of things that science
say a germ of good note.
A germ of good idea. Yeah. So the there are all sorts of things that we believe now that science has explanations for, that are credible explanations that you know, the consensus of scientists say X is caused by Y, and they're probably wrong. Just as 150 years ago, there were the kind of consensus of science. All the best scientists agreed that tuberculosis was inherited. Well, that was wrong, but it was a plausible explanation and accepted at the time. So that's part of the wrinkle of science, is that it's always moving, it's always shifting, and what we believe to be true today may not be true tomorrow. And as an observer, that's part of the fun of it.
We also have a listener named Don who says, my husband's grandfather studied with Lister. Would you comment on his role in all this? Well, we mentioned that to some extent.
Yeah, but, a great hero.
He did have a role, to be sure. And what kind of response have you been getting to this book?
I'm glad to say it's been very strong. The kind of challenge of the book for me was to take this you know, what was a one-page essay in the New England Journal of Medicine, and to spin it into something larger, and to have that anecdote really tell the story of how modern medicine happened and how scientific discoveries happen. And so it was great fun for me to kind of see there be a bounty of stuff to include and a bounty of stuff to put into this book. And ultimately, the role of the good editor that I had was to take some of that stuff out and keep on with the story itself. So I'm glad that the story and this tale has been resonating with people.
Well, it is a bountiful book. There's a lot of research that went into it. And again, we're talking to Thomas Goetz. His book is called The Remedy. It's Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and The Quest to Cure Tuberculosis, all about not only that quest, but also about perhaps even how the detective work of Sherlock Holmes figures into the medical mystery that went into curing, or at least trying to find a cure for tuberculosis. You're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's Paul from Sunnyvale. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I had a question or comment about the effect of Koch on the search for the cause of AIDS. There's Peter Duisberg at UC used Koch's postulates to try to refute the idea that HIV was the cause of AIDS, and there were apparently some things that he didn't know or didn't understand or just refused to believe about Koch's postulates. And I don't remember all of it, but maybe the author.
Well, we had Peter Duisberg on here, and I remember the whole controversy because he was a voice of one. But do you know?
So I'm not familiar with that. The challenge is, I mean, it's worth noting that HIV is a virus, and right. And Koch's postulates were developed to describe the effect of bacteria. So and in general, they're principles, right? They're a strategy for ascertaining causality, and just as the fact that they didn't know about viruses at the time, they these principles need to be adjusted for reality.
Well, Duisberg, notwithstanding the fact that he was a very celebrated virologist, a member of the National Academy of Science, essentially said that there was no connection between HIV and AIDS. And so you can imagine the kind of pummeling he got from the scientific community.
Yeah, and I mean, it's causality is a very tricky thing to pin down.
We'll get another caller on. That's you, Peter. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Michael. I just wanted to—I was interested in your conversation because I had TB when I was younger, when I was 7. I know you are proud of an educated listenership. I don't know about a listenership that's had TB, though. I don't know what fraction of listeners have experienced that. I was interested to learn that it was only a couple decades before I had TB that the— according to your guest, that there was a widespread treatment for it. I had it in the 70s.
In the 70s. And
I'm
what?
Sorry.
And you used antibiotics, I take it?
Yeah, so I had to take antibiotics, and I was 7 at the time, so I don't know what it was that I was taking, but I had to take an antibiotic every day for a year. And I've that cleared it. Of course, every time I mention on a forum that I had TB, it kind of freaks people out.
What about going to school? I mean, I remember we had screenings for TB in public schools, and there was fear that, you know, it would be spread if somebody had. Did you get to go to school on a regular basis, Peter?
Well, I think that's how it was found, but I didn't have any problems. No, I was able to go to school. I guess it was very early on in the disease, and there's just a little bit of calcification in my lungs. Although ever since then, I've had recurring problems with pneumonia, and I have no idea if there's any connection there or not, and I don't know if that's something that your guests can speak about or not. But other than that, everything's been fine.
Well, it's a fascinating story. I mean, I know that if it depends on the state of your illness, and if the lungs were damaged, it could predispose you to pneumonia later. But it's, I think, one of the interesting things about your story is how singular we think of the fact that somebody has TB. And I have a Google alert on tuberculosis, and honestly, when somebody is diagnosed, it often happens in schools these days, and when somebody is diagnosed with TB, it becomes front page news in the local newspapers. It becomes a news event, and it's such a shift from 100 years ago, 150 years ago, when everybody had the disease or was carrying the disease, and most people were dying of it in the sense of a plurality. So it just shows you how far we've shifted as a society in terms of this disease.
Glad you're okay, Peter. Thanks for
Indeed.
The call.
I'm going to go read Magic Mountain, I think, now.
So. Yeah. No, read The Remedy.
Well, that too, of course. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let me get another caller on, and that's you, Ari. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest what he thinks can or should be done to incent corporations to develop a new generation of antibiotics for strains of organisms resistant to the current generation of antibiotics. I recently read in The Atlantic Online about how there is no incentive, and we may be returning to an era, you know, where simple cuts and infections can kill people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there that's a very good point, and it is a very real issue. So I think there are a lot of scientists who are working on what would be considered a new generation of antibiotics. And actually, just last year, or at the end of 2012, a new antibiotic was approved by Johnson & Johnson, and this is effective against TB. And it was a huge effort on the part of Johnson & Johnson to develop this new drug. And frankly, they've had some trouble, making the cost benefit work for them. It's a challenge for companies to actually spend the millions of dollars it costs to develop these treatments when the need is so great that there actually is a real motivation to remove patent protection and things like that around these drugs. So it's a challenge, and I think one of the ways that we can face it is to think of other ways, vaccines, earlier treatments for these diseases, instead of just thinking about the curative processes like antibiotics.
Yeah, well said. I think we'll have to do another hour on this on forum.
Indeed.
On this subject alone. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
A pleasure.
The Remedy is the book, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and The Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. Be a good reading assignment to read that along with Magic Mountain. I agree. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.